intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, The Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
Tell you a little bit about Revolution Radio. Revolution Radio brings you a platform unlike anything on the internet today. A place where voices are heard, ideas are shared, and friendships are formed. So why not join the information revolution at freedomslips.com, where information never sleeps.
It's great. In your mind, does the world seem inverted, backward, dissonant? Dare to think out loud. You see your rights, freedoms, your very way of life being attacked, systematically eroded. Dare to think out loud. You observe traitorous evil rewarded, stealing the future from your children and grandchildren. Dare to think out loud. You question all the jingoistic propaganda claimed to be history. Dare to think out loud. You have tuned in to the right show. Dare to think out loud. Here's an expert on original source true history, your host, the Rebel Madman, Michael Gaddy.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to Dare to Think Out Loud here on the 23rd day of April in the year of mass confusion and mayhem. The crazy thing about all this, folks, is it's going to get worse from here. Looking around at my fellow citizen, I do not in any way see any portent of things getting better. It's just not there. But welcome anyway. Glad to have you with us, and don't want to start off on such a negative tune, but the truth's the truth. And, we could blow fairy tale dust on you, but that's not going to help much. Today I am joined with my wonderful producer from down south of the border, who is about to experience another lockdown, as he says, for no reason whatsoever, just because they want to. Brother Dave Scorpio, how are you doing today, buddy?
Hey, brother Mike, good to hear from you, man. Glad to be on the show with you today. Yeah, the world's just getting crazier and crazier, Mike, and I don't see any end in sight with this cycle of lies and fear that they intend to keep humanity subjugated with.
Well, a lie only works if you believe it.
Well, that's certainly true.
And we have about 300 million believers right here in this country, it would appear. Also got my very good friend from out in Western United States, out there in the wonderful city of Lake Havasu. Cal Robbins, how are you today, my friend?
Doing good today, Mike. Dave, it's good to talk to both of you today.
Well, how's things in sunny Arizona?
Oh, getting sunnier and warmer. It's that time of the year. It was actually a day to be on the lake yesterday.
Oh, wow. Yeah, we've had some nice days here the past couple of days here in South Central Georgia. But nights have been a bit cool. We've been in the 30s for two nights in a row, and that's a little unusual for late April in this part of the neighborhood.
That's global warming for you, Mike.
Yeah, obviously we're suffering global warming again. So, you know, those things happen. All we have to do is just wait until Biden gets into his climate control program and everything will straighten right up. We all know that. All we need is some more Marxist socialism and things will just be peachy keen. Well, today, Cal and I and Dave are going to discuss a subject. And, you know, if I told Cal earlier, if I was looking for a subject for the program and probably for most of my studies, I think we could put it in a pretty concise manner by saying lies my teacher told me. And the thing that I have found in my in-depth research into history, especially the founding era of the United States, the majority of things I have found have been the factual evidence and factual documents and old books and old transcripts and old lectures and all of the things that I have been able to search out over the years proves that the majority of the history that we are taught is an abject lie, and a lie on purpose. And so for years, I kind of leaned toward when I began to see that there was an issue with the Constitution, I began to say, well, you know, the Articles of Confederation, you know, it's not that bad. You know, and probably we would be a lot better off with the Articles of Confederation. And I still hold that true today. I still believe that. I believe we would be much better off with the Articles of Confederation. But after we get into it and you really do a deep dive, as I've been doing over the years, you begin to understand that the Articles of Confederation was a halfway agreement between monarchy and freedom. And one of the things that we just do not know as a people, generally, and that's because the information has been kept from us, is the fact that in the early colonial America, prior to the Revolutionary War, there was a very distinct difference in the class cult. In Europe, in England especially, it was called the country and the court. Well, the same thing was taking place in the colonies at the time. There were some wealthy people in the colonies, and those wealthy people were firmly attached to the form of government from King George. But they were doing quite well, and most of them were centered in the larger metropolitan areas of the East Coast, including Charleston, South Carolina. The planters in Charleston, South Carolina were a member of this elite class of people, the wealthy and the well-born, as our good friend Alexander Hamilton referred to them. So, but traditionally in the history of the United States, the Articles of Confederation have played the role of a villain. And historians old and new have pictured them as the product of inexperience, the parent of chaos, and the basic cause of the need for the creation of the Constitution in 1787. If you don't believe that, just read Federalist 15 by Alexander Hamilton. But in so interpreting the first Constitution of the United States and the history of the country during the existence of these articles, historians have tended to follow the lead of the people we now know today as Federalists. The Federalist Party was organized to destroy the Constitution of which we call the Articles of Confederation. That's the whole purpose of the Federalist Party. So the Federalist Party was, as I said, was organized for that destruction. So it embodied the ideals of government and economic practice abhorrent to those elements in American society of which the Federalist Party was the political expression. So to make it kind of plain and simple, the Federalists Party stood for the wealthy and the well-born, the people who had power and influence and what have you with King George. So we have to understand that when 1765, when Patrick Henry makes his presentation before the Virginia House of Burgesses, when Patrick Henry did this, Patrick Henry was a member of the country. He was a country boy who had gone broke twice. Patrick Henry was not a wealthy man at that time. But he had been elected by the people in his area of Virginia to represent them in the House of Burgesses. The one thing also that is very critical to understanding here is the fact that only a very small minority of people in the colonies had the right to vote. You had to own a certain amount of property, a certain amount of land to be allowed to vote. So when we hear that cry, "No taxation without representation," was the cause of the war, that is exactly true on many, many, you know, many, many ways of looking at it. That's exactly true. But those people didn't have any, you know, representation with the wealthy and the well-born who were running the government for King George. Now, the thing that's so hard for most people to understand is these people, the Federalists and the Federalist Party, didn't really want to split from King George because that was the source of their wealth and their power. They didn't want to split. The people who wanted to split were the rural people, the people represented by people like Samuel Adams, and Samuel Adams was not of the wealthy aristocracy in Massachusetts. Most of the Sons of Liberty were not, but some were. Dr. Joseph Warren was. But some were not, the majority were not the wealthy aristocratic class. So what was this Federalist Party? No one explained what the Federalist Party was better than did John Adams, who was a member of the wealthy and the well-born. And let's not forget, we've all heard in our history class about the Boston Massacre, how the Redcoats fired into the crowds, killing a young boy. And of course, we see that happen today with the wonderful police and what have you on various instances. The same exact thing. Who represented those Redcoats who fired into the crowd in Boston? John Adams. And we look upon it today and, you know, okay, why would Adams represent the government against the people? Great question. But it was John Adams who said, and I quote, the Federalist Party was the party of the educated, the people of talents and virtues, and the people of property in the country. So that's who the Federalist Party was. If you read the Federalist Papers today and say, oh, well, this is the great embodiment of what our government was supposed to be, you are entirely and totally duped. You do not have a clue. As a party, the Federalists did not believe in the democracy made possible under the Articles of Confederation. Now, democracy meant something back then. It meant that the people had a say in government. Not just the wealthy and well-born, not just the property owners, but the people had a say in the government was what was referred to back then as a democracy. Now, in the convention of 1787, Edmund Randolph, a member of the Federalist Party, explained that the framers of the Confederation were wise, and talking about the Articles, were wise and great men, but that, and I quote, human rights was the chief knowledge of the time. Human rights, the rights of the people. The Creator endowed rights was the knowledge of the people. when the Articles of Confederation were written. Since then, Randolph said, and I quote, "Our chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions. It is a maxim which I hold incontrovertible that the powers of government exercised by the people swallows up the other branches. None of the state constitutions have provided sufficient checks against the people." Oh, the feeble Senate of Virginia is a phantom. Maryland has a more powerful Senate, but the late distractions in that state have discovered that it is not powerful enough to restrain the people. The check established in the Constitution of New York and Massachusetts is yet a stronger barrier against the people, but they all seem insufficient," unquote. Now, imagine that. Now, you're going to say, "Hey, man, hey, Mike Gatti, that, you know, that sounds a little fishy. My teacher didn't teach me that. I didn't see that on Fox News. So it can't be true. Where did you find that?" And I will tell you, you will find it in the records of the Federal Convention of 1787 and in New Haven. And it was actually published in 1911. And you would find it in Book 1, pages 26 through 27. Wow. Okay. Well, how come my teacher didn't know that? Cal, how come your teacher didn't know that?
The odds are my teacher was a trained monkey trained by trained monkeys who was trained by another trained monkey. It's a self-perpetuating, remember that show Carbon Copy?
Yeah.
Kind of like that.
Kind of like that.
That's where we're at now. You know, after so many carbon copies, here we are.
Alexander Hamilton, our wonderful, wonderful guy that they have a play for. I didn't know he was black until that play came along. Alexander Hamilton was in profound agreement, and his statements in the convention are equally illuminating of the character and the outright purpose of the Federalist Party. Freely and openly, Hamilton declared himself in favor of a government by the rich and well-born. And he repeated that many, many times during, before, and after the convention. And he believed in the use of force to suppress the mass of the people whom he said will not conform to the dictates of reason and justice. Okay, Gatti, where'd you find that? Okay, I found that also in the same records of the Federal Convention. And also, as I mentioned before, in Federalist 15. So the Federalist Party was a party that was opposed to a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. Totally opposed to it, and they openly said so. Men who believed like Hamilton, Adams, and Edmund Randolph undertook to blacken the reputation of the Articles of Confederation. And this they did with vast success. They pictured the Confederation period as one of chaos, the critical period of American history. Again, reference Federalist 15. Sole responsibility for the chaos was laid upon the existing form of government, the Articles of Confederation. The Federalist Papers were but one portion of the propaganda in favor of the Constitution of 1787. The development of the Federalist propaganda may be traced in the contemporary press items with a tinge of special pleading began to appear before the convention met, and it continued in during its entire deliberation and burst forth in full strength once the Constitution was presented to the electorate. A couple of examples. May 14th, 1787, the Pennsylvania Gazette pictured Congress as the object of derision in Europe. In other words, the Congress under the Articles, they were just being blasted in Europe. But the people in America had no way of knowing this was true or not, just like we don't today. May 23rd, in the same paper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, it stated it was unanimously agreed that a strong executive power should be lodged somewhere and predicted chaos unless something were done. Imagine that. And while the convention was in session, a serious effort was made to prepare the public to accept its work without question. Wow. Two lines of argument were used, and one was that the members of the convention were the wisest and best men in the country. Therefore, their deliberations should be accepted without question. And if their deliberations were not accepted, chaos would ensue. Opponents of the convention were said to be inspired only by ulterior motives. Isn't that wonderful? You blame your opponent for doing what you're doing. A diversion. Oh, we don't see that at all now, do we, Dave?
Oh, that seems to be standard operating procedure. And I didn't know Alexander Hamilton was black either, but apparently Julius Caesar was black as well. So we have a lot to learn, Mike.
Well, you know, we have to do is watch TV, Dave. And, Rachel Maddow and Anderson Cooper, you know, the LGBT forces are out there, and all we have to do is listen to them. They will not lead us astray.
No. They're going to lead us into the proper morality, the morals of America.
Oh, exactly. But historians since the early 1900s have accepted, not as propaganda, but as true history, what the Federalists said was happening during that era. To approach the Articles of Confederation from the point of view of the admitted difficulties and distresses of the years after the Revolution, one would miss entirely their real significance. Logically, these articles could be approached only from the point of view of the social political turmoil out of which came the American Revolution. The war was over. Things had changed and changed drastically. And the Federalists blamed those changes on the articles and not the war. From this point of view, the nature of the Articles of Confederation, the problems involved in their construction, and the ends desired as a result of their adoption appear in a quite different light from that cast on them by history now, years and years of history, and a too willing acceptance of Federalist propaganda as historical fact. Today, that is the only history that is accepted. That is the reason that the Anti-Federalists were shut up by design for over 100 years in the writings in American history. You don't mention those Anti-Federalists, because if you do, the people might read the Anti-Federalists and see what's happening with this government is exactly what the Anti-Federalists said would happen with this government. So we have to make the Federalist viewpoint the only acceptable form. And that is true even to today. People do not want to listen. They have been so well indoctrinated, bamboozled, according to Carl Sagan. They have been so bamboozled with these lies that to accept the truth would make them uncomfortable, and they just flat ain't going to do it. And I promise you, if you start teaching or start displaying the truths of history, you are going to be bombarded with the idiots out there who believe that their opinion is more relevant than any historical fact. And they learned that in the public school system as well. They learned that their opinion, no one can say anything because of the self-esteem program of 30 years ago. No one can say anything that contrasts or contradicts your beliefs, because that would hurt your feelings. And no one can hurt your feelings. We'll get you a safe place where you can go if your feelings get hurt. And I promise you, people, with all of the lies you've been taught, the truth is going to make you damned uncomfortable. Any comments, Cal?
No, what you say, that that happens all the time when you try to speak with someone who's so indoctrinated into the greatness of the Constitution, and you bring up source documents and facts to point out, well, that's not really how it is. And they will not address any of the facts that you bring forward to them. But they will personally attack you.
Oh, yes. You must be a liberal if you say something to the alleged conservatives. You must be a liberal. If you say something to the liberals, you must be a quack job Trumpite. They are ready with the hyperbole and with the accusations and with constant attacks if you present the truth. Both sides are very, very good at it. So, you know, we're kind of stuck, but I really don't give a damn. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. If you are convinced that your opinion is more real than what the truth is, in all probability, you're wearing a mask, social distancing, and you've had your COVID shots. Because that's what stupid does. So they've taken their opinions, and they're wearing their opinions, and their opinions have made them slaves to a system, and we're seeing that full bore right now. Well, the American Revolution was far more than a war between the colonies on one hand and Britain on the other, that's for sure. There has been revealed in most of the colonies a struggle between those clothed with political power and those who had no voice in their own government. Now, you just flat aren't taught this. You flat aren't taught that the people, the common man in that period, 1765 to 1788, the common man could not even vote. He had no voice. That is what brought on the revolution. And finally, these Federalists saw that the revolution was in fact going to carry. And very quickly they decided, hey, if they triumph, we're in trouble. So we better switch sides here. We better start supporting this revolution, which they did. And ironically, in Pennsylvania, James Wilson, who was a dyed-in-the-wool monarchist, his home, when the Revolutionary Continental Army would pass by, the soldiers would actually fire into his home. That's how bad James Wilson was hated. Well, James Wilson was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention and was a member of the first Supreme Court. He was a member of the wealthy and the well-born. He was known as the Caledonian. Tench Cox was referred to in those days, also a member of the Constitutional Convention, also a strong Federalist. Tench Cox was referred to in those days as he who looks both ways. Because when at the opportune time, Tench Cox would sell. He was a merchant. He would sell his stuff to the Redcoats, or he would sell to the Continental Army, depending on who was closest with the money. You need to know who these people were at the Constitutional Convention, but one thing I've found in my studies is the great majority of people cannot name the people who were at the Constitutional Convention, but they can tell you that if you know it and you know what they were there for, that you are still wrong. And they are right. So it really gets to be a fun study. But the development of the colonies since their very foundation had seen the creation of broad social groupings based on economic and political conditions. Wealth and political power centered more and more in the coastal region, as I mentioned before, and was in the hands of the planters in the South and the merchants of the North. During the colonial period, this ruling aristocracy, which arose, kept itself in power by a number of political weapons. as wealth accumulated and concentrated along the East Coast. As the frontier moved westward from the coast and became deader and alien in character, and as the propertyless element in colonial towns grew larger, the possessors of property demanded, and I quote, a political interpretation of our favored position. Politics would be interpreted in favor of the rich. It's exactly what we have today, guys. Anthony Fauci makes more money than the president. Imagine that. Bill Gates, one of the richest men in the world. Oh, and tell me, if you will, the commoner that lives three doors down who has any voice in your government, other than the illusion of a vote. And I've said before, and it makes people so angry when I've said that voting is a pacifier that the government allows you to suck on while they steal your money and your life. That really makes them angry. But it is true. Now, the wealthy aristocracy demanded, this is during the colonial period, demanded political supremacy in order to protect their property from any economic programs of the debtor agrarians and the town poor. Colonial wealth, which had been encouraged by the British government, gradually secured the political safeguards that it demanded. The possession of a certain amount of property became the prerequisite of a right to vote. Now, I talked with Cal this morning about a book I found published in 1905, 116 years ago. And the title of that book was The Suffrage Franchise to the 13 English Colonies in America. That is one interesting book, people. But you aren't going to buy it. It's available on Amazon. It's available at Thrift Books. You aren't going to buy it because it costs $35. You know, that's $35 you can't spend on Netflix. So, you know, what's more important in your life, the truth or Netflix? Well, you know, obviously we know the answer to that one. So, newly settled areas to the west of the coast were given inadequate representation or denied representation entirely in the government. Thus, the ever-growing West found itself impossible to overcome the minority control of the East by any legal means. Therefore, people, that is what brought on the revolution. The fact that the people out west, moving westward, and the poor people who were just the worker bees in the city, they had no representation in the government. They are the people who fomented the revolution. It was not the wealthy and the well-born who would later create a constitution in 1787 to ensure their power over the other people. So it would be difficult to escape the absolute conclusion that democracy or the people was decreasingly a characteristic of constitutional development within American colonies. The oligarchical political control made possible by restrictions on voting and representation enabled the wealthy and the well-born to deny most of the popular demands of those people. Discontent simmered and occasionally flared up in a violent outburst, only to be forcibly suppressed. Forcibly suppressed, why? Because the wealthy and the well-born controlled the army, the military, the cops of the day. They control the power of coercion. Imagine that. You think that might happen now? Oh, no, that could never happen. Then, fostered by an economic depression after the French and Indian War, and aided by the bungling policy of King George and the desire of the local governing classes for independence within what was the colonial empire, Colonial radicalism became united in an effort to throw off both its local and its international bonds. You have to understand that the Revolutionary War was also not only against England, but it was against the power structure that had formed under the English control. And that power structure rested in what became the Federalist Party. You're not going to understand this if you don't get down to the nitty-gritty and start looking at it. Historians who have viewed the American Revolution from the vantage point of the internal history of the American colonies have seen the significance of the social struggle going on and its relation to the outbreak of the revolution. Now, where would I find that? Well, you know, you might have to go to a book which was published, let me see, when was this book published? Oh, 1918. And the book was titled The Boston, Massachusetts Transactions, 1916-1917. Boston, that was when it was published. I'm sorry, people. And it was, it can all be found there. And it can also be found in a book called written by Carl Becker, and it's called The Political Parties in New York. It describes the American Revolution as the result of two general movements. One, a movement for home rule and independence, and a movement for the democratization of American politics and society. Becker pictures the latter movement as fundamental and states that it began before the movement for home rule and lasted until after its achievement. People, this thing was the Revolutionary War, was a war against the policies of the Federalists, as well as against the policies of King George III. The policies of King George III and the policies of the Federalists were exactly the same thing. You want to jump in here for a second, Cal, while I get myself a taste of water?
Well, sure. Where to expound upon that? You've pretty much laid it out pretty succinctly exactly what was going on. If people recall, in Federalists, you know, Madison talks about factions and how to control factions. Well, what you've just described are those factions he was talking about, the difference between the betters and the lessers, I guess it would be the way to put it, between the aristocracy and the rest of us plebs. That was, and once again, the best way to control the opposition is to lead the opposition. The Federalists saw it, and that's what they've been doing ever since the Revolution.
Well, Cal, very well stated. And I think if you want to see the exact epitome of what I just said, let's drop back to 1765, Virginia House of Burgesses. Young farmer, businessman who had gone broke, but he was well loved in his community. This guy shows up in the Virginia House of Burgesses in May of 1765. Actually, he's there on his birthday. And he's there to represent his district. And he was told when he got there, first he was questioned because he wasn't wearing the finery and the powdered wig of the wealthy and the well-born. He just had on his homespun clothes, and which was all he could afford. And so he shows up, but he had to prove with his duly represented affidavit that he was a member of the House of Burgesses. And when he got there, the wealthy and the well-born looked down on him and told him, said, well, you know, guess what? You just find yourself a seat and listen. Because you don't speak up yet. Just doesn't happen. So you're just going to have to take your seat. So he listens for a little while about the Stamp Act. He's heard all he can take. And he stands up and he starts blasting out against King George taxing policies. He starts blasting out against the Tax Act, the Stamp Act. People, it's important to understand here that the wealthy aristocracy that controlled the Virginia House of Burgesses had no problem with the Stamp Act. They said, okay, well, you know, they had talked about it. They had discussed it and said, well, you know, well, that's just the way it is. You know, that's what the government says. And we're going to have to go along with it. You know, they probably all had on their political mask. So we're going to have to do what the government told us to do. And Patrick Henry just becomes incensed with that attitude. He jumps up. He starts talking about it. He starts saying, we don't have to do this. We do not have to acquiesce to the powers of government that oppresses us. So what did the people, what did these people who were the bastions of the wealthy, well-born federalism, the Federalist of the day, what did they yell at Patrick Henry? Treason, treason, treason. That was the cry from the Federalist. You have petitioned, you have stood up, you have spoken against government, you have spoken up for liberty, therefore you are a traitor. Many years later at the Constitutional Convention, Patrick Henry would bring up that day when he had been called a traitor by this same class who wrote a constitution in 1787. If you take the time to understand that the Constitution of 1787 was written by the same people who call Patrick Henry a traitor. You know, they didn't like Patrick Henry. They never liked Patrick Henry. Because Patrick Henry is the only person that I can find among the founders, the prominent founders, is the only one who at the Virginia Ratification Convention on June the 4th of 1788 said, I am here as a representative of the liberties and the freedom of the people. No one else ever said that. He's the only one who said that he represented the freedom and the liberties of the people. The Federalist represented the wealthy and the well-born. Any thoughts on this, Dave, so far?
I was curious, you know, when you were talking about the revolution and the it was essentially, you know, a reaction against the forces that became or the Federalists later. Do you think that many people were aware of the role that the Central Bank of London was playing in these powers? Or was that a fairly obscure and hidden piece of information at the time?
Dave, I think it was primarily hidden. I don't think they knew it, in all honesty. Here were a people, much like the people today, who are, you know, very little concerned about the Federal Reserve. You know, and how do you get people not to question the Federal Reserve? You send them a stimulus check. The people aren't concerned about this. You know, the people are just, they're trying to get by day to day. They're trying to get an existence. They want to spend time with their children. You know, they want an existence for themselves, and they really don't care what the government is doing as long as the government doesn't make them uncomfortable. And now the government's beginning to make them uncomfortable. But if you tell them why the government's making them uncomfortable, it's been in place and something they have embraced forever. Oh boy, do they get mad at you. And it's they have adopted the damn you. Whatever you do, do not tell me the truth. I don't want to hear it.
Yeah, and getting that magic stimulus check is a great way to divert the attention. You're absolutely right.
Well, you know, I did some math not too long ago, something I'm not really good at, but I did some math and I figured out that if this last stimulus check was $1.9 trillion, if we divided that up among 330 million people, that comes to a whole lot more than $1,400. Where'd the rest of it go?
Well, Mike, as I understand it, you know, a great deal of that is to simply bail out the states to keep their, you know, bloated, you know, class of bureaucrats in jobs now that they've systematically destroyed a good portion of their economies.
Well, there's no argument to be made against that point, Dave, but, you know, the same thing happened when we stop and think about it, you know, back in 2008 through 2010 and that great fiasco where we bailed out all the banks and we sent out about $1 trillion back then. And someone said, well, hey, he said, if you divided that up among the adult people of America, that $1 trillion, instead of giving it to the banks, if you gave it to the people, everybody would have gotten a check for about $250,000. Oh, no, we can't help the people. We have to help the banks. I'm puzzled as to what's it actually going to take before the people realize what's happening here. We're going to take, and back in 2008 through 2010, which I believe really started this collapse, when they said, okay, well, we're going to take about $1 trillion. They started off with $900 billion, but it ended up being over $1 trillion. We're going to start out with over $1 trillion here, and we're going to take this out, and we're going to bail out the banks that just screwed you out of your property in the mortgage fraud. How brilliant do you have to be to ignore that? I mean, there were literally tens of thousands of people who lost their homes under this fraud in 2008 through 2010, all this foreclosure fraud. And one of the things that a lot of people don't notice is that the banks were bailed out, and then the banks were charged with fraud against the American people by taking their homes under fraudulent circumstances, and the banks paid fines to the federal government. Well, what about this picture can't you figure out? Okay, all right, you banks, you go out, you foreclose on people's property. You foreclose on people's property that aren't even behind in their payments. Bank of America foreclosed on people's property that Bank of America didn't even have a mortgage on. And they did all of this stuff back then. So who gets bailed out? The people? No, we bail out the banks that did the crime. And then a few months down the line, the federal government says, okay, you banks, you foreclosed on these people's property. So here, we're going to fine you so much money. So what happened? Did the federal government give the banks a bailout money and then the banks give the money back to the federal government in fines? Pretty crafty operation, wouldn't you say? Cal, you still awake for us, buddy?
Oh, yeah, I'm still here. I'm just listening to you explain it. Hopefully what you're telling people is sinking in the corruption and the lies that have been going on. It's all right there if you just stop and look at it. If you turn the TV off and hopefully engage your brain and dare to think, you can see it.
Well, I'll move on here with a little bit about this early fraud in the colonies. This to me is so compelling. And thanks, Cal. But another common assumption in treating the political history of the American Revolution is that all of the revolutionists were the radicals. That, as time passed, the bitter experience taught them, the fathers of the revolution repented of their radical beliefs and became Federalist. The fact that a man became a revolutionist is no proof of his political radicalism. Men like George Washington, James Wilson, Robert R. Livingston, John Dickinson, Edward Rutledge, and Charles Carroll were always Federalist in political philosophy and practice. None of them adopted the people's ideas, which were trumpeted by people like Patrick Henry and Samuel Adams and the Sons of Liberty. Think about that. These people, George Washington, James Wilson, Robert R. Livingston, John Dickinson, Ed Rutledge, and Charles Carroll, these were rich, wealthy, and well-born. George Washington did never adopt the philosophy of Patrick Henry. Never. So that is something that people don't think about. None of these, as I said, none of them adopted the people's ideas. And none of them accepted independence as the only solution of the troubles between the colonies and Great Britain. The evidence shows that the Federalists were as strongly opposed as the Radicals to British measures threatening colonial home rule. But the bulk of them, the bulk of the Federalists, wanted no rupture of the connection with Britain. For that connection seemed to offer far more than a dubious future as an independent group of states. The Federalists actually wanted to stay with Britain, with the proposals of Britain. Now, let's go to the Constitutional Convention, just jumping around here. And, of course, everyone was taught about John Francis Mercer. Right, guys? Both of you taught about John Francis Mercer in your high school classes?
Never.
No, absolutely not.
Well, funny, old John Francis Mercer is elected to the Constitutional Convention. He goes there, but he leaves. He's one of those who left. He didn't even stay long enough to vote against the Constitution or to vote for it. He left, and he left before Luther Martin. Both of them were from Maryland. John Francis Carroll sends a list back to Luther Martin of 20 men at the Constitutional Convention he said were there to create another monarchy just like King George. He published a list of 20. Now, I would challenge you, get with your Google and see if you can find that list. Now, why would they hide that list? If it was false, they would say, look what that crazy guy from Maryland said. But one of the first to see the Federalist dilemma and to state his preference was, believe it or not, good old Gouverneur Morris. He explained that the ruling aristocracy had fooled the people over a long period of time, and that the masses were beginning to wake up. They were beginning to realize it. If the attempt to deceive them were continued, he wrote, farewell, aristocracy. If the disputes with Great Britain continue, we shall be under the worst of all dominions. We shall be under the domination of a riotous mob of people. Unquote. What could the aristocracy do to save itself? Morris already had a candid answer for them. Okay, Federalist, we're in a hell of a shape here. If we get into this revolution and the radical people win this revolution, we're in trouble. Away goes our wealth. Away goes everything, and they will rule the country. But what can we do? Morris again had an answer ready. He said, and I quote, it is the interest of all men, therefore, to seek for reunion with the parent state. We need to seek a reunion with Britain. Morris thus saw what others were not to see for a year or even for 2 years, namely the connection with Britain was the guarantee of the aristocratic order within the colonies. The growing awareness of that fact does much to explain the attitude of the Federalists toward the idea of independence and toward the idea of a common government once independence could not be avoided. Once this Ragabond army was about to defeat the most powerful army on the planet, and these Federalists saw that there was no way to stop it, then what did they do? We'll talk about that back on the flip side. Thanks, folks, for tuning in to Dare to Think Out Loud.
And also the daughters of men, indicating that there were giants before the Nephilim.
And sons of God plural. They weren't talking about Jesus coming down.
No, that's right. Yeah.
I'm Steve Crawford, host of Factor Theory Live. Join me every Sunday night from 10 p.m. till midnight Eastern Standard Time on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. Check it out.
Transcending time and space, let us take you to the place inside your mind where thoughts divide and mysteries unwind. Join us every Monday evening right here on Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, and you will catch the Fenton Perspective with our great host, Lorian Fenton. Come listen in as she shares her amazing stories from the past to present, along with all of her guest secrets to the future. That's the Fenton Perspective every Monday evening right here from 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, only on Revolution Radio. Oh, and you don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Galactic Interstellar Council on Revolution Radio Studio A, Fridays at 2 p.m. Eastern. Join us as we traverse the starseed paradigm, as expressed in the time-space continuum that we know as the divine expression of love and light. Integrating this conscious unity into the galactic paradigm. So welcome all, both terrestrial beings and galactic beings as one. So be it. You're listening to Revolution Radio.
Tried for years and years to use passive resistance and loud voices to make a change. But time is over. Your governments around the world have no other goal than to decimate your entire existence at the hands of the bankers and the elites. The war is coming. And it's your choice to decide if you want to be a warrior or a victim. Denial is not a choice anymore. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, the number one listener-supported radio station on the planet. Not giving up. Revolution Radio. All right. Thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
Well, welcome back, folks, to Dare to Think Out Loud. We're having a discussion here, kind of one-sided. I've been yapping too much, I believe. Having a one-sided conversation here about what was actually happening in colonial America that led to the independence, and who was for independence and who was not. Dave, have I been making any sense at all? Are you getting the gist of where I'm trying to lead you here?
Oh, absolutely. And it's just interesting how the forces that essentially, were starting the revolution in terms of, reaction against it, ended up taking over the reins of power after the revolution was over. It's really quite an amazing circle.
And thanks, Dave. Cal, am I making any sense to you, buddy?
Oh, you're making total sense to me, but I was thinking about this during the break. Sometimes in explaining this stuff, it's kind of like trying to explain algebra to somebody who can't grasp the concept of even numbers. I don't want to be explaining things above the heads of people's understanding. But it's difficult to step back down to that level and speak of intricate history on such an elementary level when it's so much more detailed. It's so much more than, the history of that era is so much more than George Washington cutting down a cherry tree.
Well, that is so correct. And you reminded me of what my wife told me several years ago in my efforts when I was doing classes and writing articles and doing all this stuff. She looked at me one day and she said, "You do realize, honey, that you're trying to teach history to a butter knife." So I guess that was correct. But I'm going to proceed here anyway and then try to get a few comments out of you guys a little bit more this hour. But there was this guy named Alexander Graydon, G-R-A-Y-D-O-N, probably someone most of you have never heard anything about. But I found in some writings of Mr. Graydon, he had a thing called The Memoirs of His Own Times. And he published these in Philadelphia in 1846. Now, you're going to have a hard time finding those, but he said something kind of, unless you go to the National Archives, if they're still available there. But one of the things I found kind of interesting was when Graydon returned to Philadelphia in 1776. Now, remember, this is early on in the Revolution. He found that many of those who had formerly been much in favor of liberty were no longer so ardent. The reason Graydon stated in his paper was that, and I quote, "power, to use a language which had already ceased to be orthodox and could, therefore, only be whispered, had fallen into the hands of the lowly citizen." It was, in fact, just beginning to be perceived that the ardor of the inflamed multitude is not to be tempered, and that the instigators of revolution are rarely those who are destined to conclude them or profit from them. Again, that was from Mr. Graydon's Memoirs of His Own Times, published 1846. Now, good old John Adams, our second president, viewed the matter in somewhat the exact same fashion. Now, I would take this from his autobiography. And in his autobiography, he wrote, and I quote, "The gentleman in Pennsylvania who had been attached to the proprietary interest and owed their wealth and honors to it," he's talking about the king here, people, "and the great body of the Quakers had hitherto acquiesced in the measures of the colonies, or at least had made no professed opposition to them. Many of both descriptions had declared themselves with us and had been as explicit and as ardent as we are. But now these people began to see that independence was approaching. They started backwards." That's found on page 407 of John Adams' autobiography, for those of you who question. What Adams said of Pennsylvania was equally true of the colonies in New York, Maryland, and South Carolina, where the Federalists still retained control in 1775 and 1776. Well, let's look around at this and see if we find anything else here. Independence was thus seen in 1776 by the Federalists as an evil of which internal discord and revolution seemed to be its inevitable twin. And I quote, "We do not want to be independent," wrote Joseph Hughes, merchant of North Carolina and a delegate to the Congress. "We want no revolution unless a change of ministry and measures would be deemed such." Okay, well, Gaddy, where'd you get that? All right, I got that from a letter from a gentleman in North Carolina and one of the delegates of the Congress, Joseph Hughes, to a principal house in Edinburgh, Scotland, in Edenton, July the 31st, 1775. Imagine that. Feeling thus and faced with what seemed political ruin, the Federalists in the Second Continental Congress opposed every measure that smacked of independence. Led by John Dickinson, they sent a second petition to the king in the summer of 1775. They rejected independence, people. The Second Continental Congress, led by the rich and well-born, they rejected it. Twice they rejected consideration of Benjamin Franklin's colonial home rule policies. The bulk of the Federalists wanted no rupture of the connection with the British Empire, for that connection seemed to offer far more than a dubious future as an independent group of states. Increasingly, the Federalists opposed a complete break as they became aware that independence might result in a revolution within the colonies and their loss of power. And they became aware that the Federalist rule had more to fear from the people of the colonies than it ever had to fear from King George III. Ooh, wow. So where did you find that, Gaddy? Well, I found that in a writing by Herbert Friedenwald. And it was called The Declaration of Independence. And it was published in 1905. You will find my quotes on page 78 to 80. And it was made clear here that a statement of the difficult position of the Federalists and the effect it would have on the question of independence. So the Federalists said, look, if the people are going to run this damn government, if the war succeeds, if the people are going to be in charge, we're in trouble, people. We have to do something. So, you know, what do we do? So, Cal, what are your thoughts, buddy?
Well, first off, if I drop off, it's because my phone is dying for some reason. It's plugged in and charging, but I'm losing battery. So I might not be able to finish this, just so you're aware. If I disappear, it's not by choice. Trying to explain to people that the biggest threat to the Federalists was actually coming from within the colonies itself, and not from King George, it's a perspective that actually puts everything into perspective. Once you understand that, this is what they did. Once again, you know, if you want to control the opposition, you need to lead the opposition. And it wasn't to the Federalists, to the wealthy merchants, the aristocracy, to the well-born and high-bred, the crown was not a threat. It was the people that were a threat, the people in the colony that were an actual threat to their power.
Well, the thing that I find incredible here is that these Federalists, and, you know, this is before they called themselves Federalists, was that they took positive as well as negative action. And they were worried when John Adams' plea for the abolition of customs houses and the establishment of independent state governments, the formation of a confederation, and the opening of the ports of the colonies to the world. That troubled them. Furthermore, they took positive, as I said, positive as well as negative action. John Dickinson, who was their leader, this time in a movement to secure instructions from the colonial assemblies yet in control of the Federalists, instructions directing the delegates of the assemblies to vote against independence should the matter come up in Congress. Okay, Gaddy, where'd you find that one? Well, I found that in a letter from John Adams to James Warren on July the 6th, 1775. And it can be found in the Warren Adams papers and John Adams' autobiography as well. So the Federalists retained their control of Congress until February of 1776, when they met their first significant defeat, when George III charged that the rebellious war now levied is now become more general and is manifestly carried on for the purpose of establishing an independent empire. The Federalists in Congress attempted to send an address to the colonies denying that independence was the purpose of the Congress. Congress rejected this address, which was written by James Wilson, the Caledonian. And from that moment on began a steady drive in the direction of independence. The Federalists realized that this thing was going towards independence and they better change sides in a heartbeat. So suddenly independence is called for openly in the Congress. The radicals or the Sons of Liberty or the Patrick Henry section, whatever you want to call them, demanded the appointment of a committee to prepare a confederation. Resolutions were offered to the effect that the colonies had a right to make alliances with foreign powers. Soon the ports of the colonies were declared open to the world. Finally, on May the 15th, 1776, Congress passed what John Adams declared to be the most important resolution ever passed in America. What Congress did was to invite a revolution in those colonies, yet within the hands of the Federalists. Of course, in the purpose of independence, the Adams group responded positively. The government of Pennsylvania was toppled from its position, and the last bulwark of Federalist opposition to independence was therefore eliminated. This is in May of 1776. The Federalists now had to choose between England and the colonies, between loyalism and patriotism. Many became loyalists, as some had done before this time. Fearfully and reluctantly, the victims of circumstances, partly of their own creation, but others became revolutionists. Now, those conservatives who became revolutionists, whether willingly or not, did not throw away their ideas of government. They were too cool, too long accustomed to government and their own interests to be led astray by the floods of radical propaganda by the Sons of Liberty. They were not to be swept along in an idealistic attempt to create independent democracy. Their dislike of independence was in part the result of their fear of the people. and they have tried to avoid both. They failed, and they therefore changed their tactics. They have now attempted to delay independence until a common government could be created. Such matters as confederation and foreign alliances, which they had opposed for a year, now quite suddenly became indispensable prerequisites of independence. Now, you can find that, folks, in letters between John Adams and James Warren in the Warren Adams collection. And you can also find that from Joseph Galloway's Historical and Political Reflections on the Rise and Progress of the American Rebellion, which was published in London, England in 1780. So that one's got a little age on it, too. Cal, you still with us, buddy?
Yeah, for now. For now, I'm still here.
Okay.
It's dying, but hopefully I'll hang in there as long as I can.
Okay. Am I making this clear? Do I need to break it down further?
It's clear to me, but, you know, I mean, you're explaining things I've already come to realize for myself. I don't know if Bubis is understanding this. I mean, you're trying to tell them that these venerated saints of the revolution, at least venerated in their minds, are not these saints that we've been told that our teachers lied to us about and told us they were. That's a tough pill to swallow for someone. I mean, when you're so steeped in American mythology, it's a tough thing to break that thought process.
Absolutely, and you and I see that on a daily basis, my friend.
Oh, but definitely.
In a way, the Federalists knew what kind of a government they wanted. Absolutely. They wanted a centralized government which would take the place of the British government. A government which would regulate trade, control the disposition of the lands, provide force to quell internal dissension. They did not need the experience of the revolution to demonstrate what were for them the benefits of such a government. They had been stating their ideas on the subject since the meeting of the First Continental Congress. In that body, Joseph Galloway had argued in behalf of his plan of union that while the colonies denied the authority of Parliament, they were in their relations to one another in a perfect state of nature, and that conflict between colony and colony was at this moment only suppressed by the authority of the parent state, and should that authority be weakened or annulled, many subjects of unsettled disputes, and which in that case can only be settled by an appeal to the sword, and must involve us all in the horrors of a civil war. Arguments for this coercive superintending power of the Federalists were not confined only to those Federalists who became Loyalists. In other words, this idea, some went back to England. Benjamin Franklin's son went back to England. Some of them stayed loyal to England throughout. Some of these people loyal to England were delegates to the Constitutional Convention. That became quite apparent. The Federalists who were to become revolutionists were equally clear in their beliefs. Galloway had argued that some power must have the right to regulate trade for all of the colonies since they were incapable of doing it for themselves. So did James Duane and John Dickinson. We don't hear about them very much. The Federalists also conceived of union as desirable for the purpose of making what they referred to as laws relative to the general police of America. This would have a tendency of checking a turbulent spirit in any one of the colonies, unquote. The turbulent spirit which appeared in Shays' Rebellion against the taxes when the people in Western Massachusetts realized that there was no difference whatsoever in the new government and the old government under King George III. In 1776, the Federalists were also genuinely alarmed at the possibility of a civil war among the colonies if independence were to be declared. Carter Braxton of Virginia wrote that if this happened, and I quote, "The continent would be torn in pieces by intestine wars and convulsions," unquote. Intercolonial disputes should be settled before independence, and above all, and I quote, "A grand continental league must be formed with a superintending power," unquote. This idea was expressed eloquently by Edward Biddle, who declared, and I quote, "The subjugation of my country I deprecate as a most grievous calamity, and yet sicken at the idea of 13 unconnected petty democracies. If we are to be independent, let us, in the name of God, at once have an empire and place George Washington at the head of it," unquote. Okay, where did you see that, Gaddy? Well, Carter Braxton to Landon Carter, Philadelphia, April 14, 1776. Braxton feared civil war particularly because of conflicting land claims. His fear was justified because minor hostilities had actually been engaged in. So on June the 7th, 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moved that the colonies were and of a right ought to be free and independent states, and that they should form a confederation, and that committee should be appointed to draw up the document. The Federalists opposed his motion. In their own estimation, they were the sensible part of the government. They did not object to the formation of a confederation, nor the formulation of plans for a treaty with France. But from their point of view, the only reason offered for declaring independence was the reason of a madman, a show of our spirit. Independence would only render the colonies ridiculous in the eyes of foreign powers, who would not unite with the colonies before they had united among themselves. Likewise, daily experience showed, and I quote, that the inhabitants of every colony consider themselves at liberty to do as they please upon almost every occasion, and this cannot be tolerated. Holy crap. And where would you find that, Gaddy? Edward Rutledge to John Jay, Philadelphia, June 8, 1776. Any thoughts, Dave?
No, you keep going. This is good stuff, Mike.
Well, you got to talk long enough for me to get a drink of water, Dave. Takes a little longer than that. But thank you. John Dickinson, Robert Livingston, James Wilson, Edward Rutledge, and James Duane all too become unwilling revolutionists within the same month. They led in the opposition to declaring independence but saw no other path. Consideration of the question was thus delayed until July the 1st, when John Dickinson made a formal speech in which he set forth the Federalist views for the last time before the adoption of the Declaration of Independence. He pleaded once more the necessity of union before independence, and he pointed to the difficulties of the committee engaged in the preparation of the Articles of Confederation. In particular, he urged the necessity of a central power to control the Western lands. Land speculators, Federalists, same thing. Once independence was declared, the Federalists continued to hope for the establishment of a supreme national legislature. There is no clearer statement of this desire than that by Joseph Reed at the time, who was the private secretary to George Washington. He was still in hopes of reconciliation with England, but he was for a national union among the 13 states either way, and a mere local authority which should be subservient to the supreme decision of those in power. Now, where'd you find that? Well, okay, I think I found that in a letter from Joseph Reed to Robert Morris. Oh, imagine that. Reed frankly admitted that his motives were personal. Then I quote, "From the purity and extent of its intelligence, and the abilities of its members, I derive from my hope of political safety, and therefore be held with concern every attempt to control the judgment and bind down the opinions of any of its members by instructions and other devices. He did not want the Federalists in any way controlled by the people. Oh, wow. This is just so incredible on so many ways. The Federalists had an opportunity of sorts to create the government they desired, for they dominated the committee which prepared the first draft of the Articles of Confederation. It was presented to Congress in the handwriting of John Dickinson. To a degree, this first draft of the Articles of Confederation was an expression of the Federalist desire for a central government superior to the states. In the committee, they made a strenuous effort to destroy what they referred to as an, I quote, provincial distinction, and to make everything of the most minute kind bend to what they call the good of the whole, the old general welfare. But the draft presented to Congress did not contain many practical measures for the achievement of their purpose. Various reasons may be assigned for their failure. The two radicals, or the Patrick Henry folks on the committee, doubtless exercised their influence. More important was the fact that the Southern conservatives were obsessed with a fear of the New England Federalist. Woo-hoo! They were convinced that a national government would be subject to the whole country, that a national government, I'm sorry, would subject the whole country to the rule of the New England junto. Probably the greatest restraint upon the work of the committee was the realization that most of the state governments would never knowingly accept a superior government placed over all of them. Cal, you still with us, buddy? Yeah, he either can't unmute or he's gone, and I'm sorry about that, folks. But let me see, where did I leave off here? You got any comments, Dave, while I get my papers together?
Yeah, it looks like Cal dropped off the call. I think his battery must have
finally given up.
Dropped. Yeah. I'll try to get him back on the call.
Okay. Well, do you want to babble on here for a second while I try to find my place in my paper?
Well, I would just add that, Mike, your research really gets to the core of some major problems with people's belief systems and having being taught history that is based on mythology. And it all leads to a belief in a federal government that has been rotten since the beginning. And now we're really seeing it manifests to the point where it's actively trying to destroy people's lives, essentially.
Well, exactly. You go ahead and see if you can dig up Cal for us. I think
I'm calling him now.
I'll continue with the program here. In spite of the obstacles in the way of their radicalism, the Federalists under the Dickinson draft gave to Congress power over what was probably the most important subject of controversy at the time, which was the western lands and the state boundaries. Congress was given power to limit the size of states, to define their boundaries, and to settle disputes over rival land claims. This grant of power was the most bitterly contested issue during the writing and ratification of the Articles of Confederation. States with definite western boundaries, like Maryland and Pennsylvania, were in bitter opposition to states like Virginia, whose land claims were vast in extent. The landless states wanted to share in the profits expected from future sales. Oh, money. Imagine that. Oh. Their speculators wanted their pre-revolutionary land claims made good. They also feared the domination of Virginia should she expand into the West. Hence, the landless states of New England appealed to a centralized government after independence as they had appealed to Great Britain before. Only a superior power could force the landed states to disengage. The appeal was all the more effective since the leading politicians of the landless states were also their leading land speculators. Imagine that. But the landed states defeated this effort to give Congress these large powers, and for their further security, they added to the Articles of Confederation in their final form a provision to the effect that no state was to be deprived of its territory without its own consent, which Abraham Lincoln quickly blew out of the water in 1864. The question of the basis of representation likewise involved the question of the nature of the government to be created. Was each state to have one vote in Congress, or were the states to be represented in Congress in proportion to their population or their wealth? The first Congress had decided that each state should have but one vote, and the Dickinson draft of the Articles continued this same precedent. But the large states, led by Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, and Virginia, insisted that votes should be according to the population. They engaged in a dialectical argument to gain their end. The most significant argument used was that the delegates in Congress represented the people of the United States and not the people of the individual states, and that therefore voting should be according to population. The individuality of the colonies is a mere sound, said John Adams. You back with us, Cal?
Yeah, I believe I'm back on. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, hopefully we can stay on here. I've had to change phone cables, I think.
Okay, well, good. Oh, those old Patrick Henry, Samuel Adams, Sons of Liberty guys opposed this proposed measure, so dangerous in its implications for self-government within the states. The small states opposed it, for they feared they would be either swallowed up or dominated by their large neighbors. In answer to the contentions of the large states, they insisted that the members of Congress represented the states and not individuals, and that every colony is a distinct person. Imagine that. The final result was a victory for the Henry folks and the small states. Each state had one vote in the deliberations of Congress. The controversy over representation was of a far more consequence than as evidence of a struggle between large and small states. It also involved the question of sovereignty, the location of ultimate political authority. The location of sovereignty during the American Revolution was a question of practical politics, not a constitution of constitutional metaphysics. No one realized this better than the contemporary politicians who believed that the colonists could choose between a sovereign state or a number of confederated sovereign states when they organized their government. So, Cal, any thoughts, my friend? Well, I guess he's not there. Dave, any thoughts, my friend?
Yeah, it looks like Cal dropped off the call again.
Well, he's having problems. I know what that's like. I've been through those before. But do you have any thoughts on this?
No, just continue. I'm just really enjoying listening. And yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you. Cal and I were discussing this past week when we were talking about this program today. We were discussing, I brought up the guy who wrote Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation. And Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation is quite important. And I will be bringing that up while I talk about this. But Article 2 was introduced and entirely written by one guy. And so this one guy was a gentleman by the name of Thomas Burke. And so I thought it was very unusual that Thomas Burke composed the whole thing. And, well, let me read it so you'll get an idea of how important it actually is. Article 2 says, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. Now, those are simple words. But what it meant was that the state, the only power the federal government had was the powers that the states expressly delegated to them. And I always thought, you know, gosh, I grew up in North Carolina in a neighboring county to Burke County, which was named for Thomas Jefferson. Thomas Burke. On several occasions, I had North Carolina history in school. All I heard, ever remember hearing, even going back and looking at some of the old books, was that Thomas Burke was an important figure in the American Revolution. That's it. No philosophy, what he stood for. Why would a man who was of your state, someone that you would embrace, you named a county after him, why wouldn't you say that he wrote Article 2 of the Articles of Confederation? Because the Federalists felt like there were two articles in the Articles of Confederation that limited them and they couldn't allow them to exist, and that was Article 2 and Article 13. So the Federalists totally opposed, again, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States and Congress assembled. People, if you had that today, there would be no gun control. There would be no abortion. There would be so many things that you wish you had, you would have under Article 2. The Federalists could not allow that to continue. Let me read it one more time. Each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this confederation, expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. A state could say no to anything the federal government wanted to do, which was not expressly delegated as a power to the federal government. During my lifetime, the great majority of things that this federal government has done are totally unconstitutional. As weak as the Constitution is, they still don't go by it. Every gun control law in this country is unconstitutional, people. Every one of them. And as I expressed on Facebook this morning, 10 out of 10 criminals prefer disarmed victims. Your government is a criminal operation. What else do you need to know? Criminals don't want you to have the means to resist. Your government wants the people disarmed because they do not want to give the people the power to resist. They came up with the National Gun Control Act in 1934 under specious circumstances, very questionable circumstances, to make sure that the people could not have the same arms of the military and the police. The fact that the government doesn't want you to be armed like they are should scare the hell out of you. But that's not going to happen, you know. As my grandfather said so eloquently one time, boy, you can add all the mayonnaise you want and you can stir like hell, but you can't make chicken salad out of chicken shit. And therefore, that is an analogy to try to educate the American populace that they have succumbed totally to the tyranny of a centralized government. a totalitarian government, which they all become without limits. They all become totalitarian in nature. So help me out, Dave. I need another drink of water. Oh, wow. Looks like I've been deserted here. I'm out here on this lonely island all by myself. Cow failed. And then, guess what? My friend Dave took a leave of absence on me here. So, you know, guys, I wish that there was something, some way, you know, that we could say, hey, there's some hope out here somewhere. You know, and we could have some hopium. Oh, I forgot. Q already provides opium. Oh. Well, we talked about the Articles of Confederation and how they were limited. You know, and how they limited government and why the Federalists had to change this. And I spoke of Thomas Burke. And Thomas Burke proposed that amendment that I was telling you about, that all sovereign powers in the states separately, and that particular acts of it, which should be expressly enumerated, would be exercised in conjunction and not otherwise. But that in all things else, each state would exercise all the rights and power of sovereignty uncontrolled. Members of Congress were so slow to become aware of the significance of the proposed amendment that even a second was wanting for quite some time. James Wilson, the Caledonian, and Richard Henry Lee furnished most of the opposition to Thomas Burke's proposition. But eventually, 11 of the 13 states voted for it. As it stands in the Articles, the amendment reads, and I will say it again, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every state jurisdiction and right which is not by this confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. The Constitution thus written was presented to the states for unanimous ratification before it could be declared in operation. Unanimous ratification was delayed for years by the continuance of the controversy over congressional control of the uncharted lands of the West. Maryland finally just flat refused to ratify the thing unless the landed states would agree to make some cession of their Western lands to the Congress. This was done in 1780, and on March the 1st, 1781, the Articles of Confederation became the first Constitution of the United States. This Constitution was, as James Wilson would later say, how different. The constitutional relationship between the states and their common government was quite unlike what it had been in the original draft. The vast field of undefined and unenumerated powers now lay with the states rather than with the central government. Congress was rigidly constructed within the bounds of precisely delegated authority. Congress was the creature of the states and ultimately of the people of the states. Centralized government with a legal veto on laws, with the power of general legislation, and with the force of arms, had disappeared with the Declaration of Independence. The conservative revolutionists had been unable to recreate such a government over the American states in spite of all of their efforts to do so. The Constitution finally adopted was the Constitution of those elements of American society which helped to bring about the American Revolution. Insofar as those elements were democratic, the Constitution they created was also democratic. It was democratic because within a state, the majority of the electorate could do as it pleased, unhindered by any external coercive or restrictive authority of a central government. Thus, Edmund Randolph's statement in the Convention of 1787 takes on meaning and color. He objected then that the chief knowledge of the framers of the Confederation was human rights. Since then, the chief danger arises from the democratic parts of our constitutions. The powers of government exercised by the people will always swallow up the other branches. None of the constitutions have provided sufficient check against the people. The problem of the more general nature of the Articles of Confederation was lost sight of in the confusion surrounding the controversy over the control of the Western lands. As soon as the Articles were ratified, however, an attempt was made to add the nationalistic empirical features to them. This failed, as did the efforts made to interpret the Articles in a nationalistic term. So all efforts were made. Then we ended up with the taxing provision under the Articles of Confederation. The Federalists worked as hard as they could, and even in control of Congress, to get their taxing schemes on the people, to aggrandize themselves, to make them keep their wealth and to keep their power. The taxing structures they kept trying to impose on every state because of Article 13 had to be approved by every state. And time again, they were repulsed by the people of the states who said, not no to your taxing schemes, but hell no to your taxing schemes. This prompted the Federalists to make a campaign, a covert and overt campaign, to create an entirely new document which would give the central government complete and total powers over the states and the people, which they created with the Constitution of 1787. Now, the fact that you have Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, unlimited taxation from unlimited sources, providing that it is for the general welfare. The general welfare means that I can take from you and give it to him if I want to. That's the general welfare. That's a wonderful phrase with a very, very duplicitous meaning. It's there for a reason. For the general welfare. General welfare is a socialist term. The common good is a socialist term. The Constitution, as prepared in 1787, as written in 1787, was a socialist form of government. And you can tell me, no, it wasn't. Donald Trump can say, we've never been a socialist country. All these people can say, no, until hell freezes over. It doesn't change Article 1, Section 8. And Article 1, Section 8, Clause 1, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18. Which gives the government the right to do anything that it considers to be necessary and proper. Well, anything the government considers to be necessary and proper was later espoused by Justice Scalia when he said the rights of the people are subject to reasonable restrictions. Do the people get to decide what's reasonable? No. You do not get to decide what's reasonable, what restrictions on your freedoms are reasonable. You don't get to decide that. Somebody else does. An oligarchy of 8 lawyers, unelected, politically well-connected, get to decide what is reasonable about your rights. And if someone else can decide what about your rights are reasonable, you don't have any rights. So it becomes a very, very simple explanation. And, you know, in all candor, I really enjoy a good discussion, or a good, if you want to call it a debate. I enjoy a good debate on the merits of the Constitution, the history of the Constitution, the history of our country. I enjoy that. I really do. But if you want to engage in a debate, if you want to engage in a discussion, don't come under the false pretense that your opinion is outweighs documented history. You can't tell me that because your history teacher, who wasn't alive in 1787, that your history teacher, who told you so-and-so, knows more about what happened than did a letter between James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. What you read in a history book, or what you read on YouTube, or saw on YouTube, or what you Googled that told you blah, 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 that the people have rights, the people have this, the people have that. The fact that you were told that, people, does not overbalance what was said by the people who were involved in the formation of this government to each other. It just doesn't work. It never will. Well, again, I would love to engage in discussion or debate with anyone who brings with them not opinion, but documented evidence. Because documented evidence will change my mind. And that's what I look for. Your opinion will not. So I really appreciate you folks putting up with me today. I'm sorry that we lost Cal. I'm sorry that Dave's here somewhere. Dave, is that you?
Yeah, I'm here. I just had to step away for a second. Mike, this has been a great show. And, you know, as you've stated in the past, the power to tax is the power to destroy. Of course, that was said by someone that was running a state when the gun was turned on them. But we see this all coming to fruition today. Everything that you're talking about in this history is coming to fruition today. It's really quite incredible.
I love bringing out the parallels. Thanks for mentioning that, Dave. Dave, who are you having on tomorrow on your program?
Tomorrow I'm having Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson. For the first hour, we're going to talk about this cooked up war against Russia and the demonization of Russia, and how basically everything in the world is Russia's fault somehow. And then our final hour, I'm going to have Steve from the UK on. We're going to talk about new platforms and ways to avoid internet censorship and all kinds of other stuff too.
Well, thanks, Dave. And we would like to invite Dave, and I certainly would like to invite everyone. And if Cal were with us, he would do the same. We would like to invite everyone to donate to this free speech platform. It doesn't go to the host. It doesn't go to any of us. It doesn't go to the people who work there. But it goes to keep this platform open. And free speech is pretty well gone, people. And it depends upon your support to bring it forward. I hope you will join me Sunday evening. My friend Daryl Wayne from Alabama and our good friend Robert Hudson from out there in Nevada, we will get together to talk about Reconstruction in the United States and how that parallels the Reconstruction that we are experiencing currently. So, folks, thanks so much for listening in today. We appreciate it. I want to throw out another thanks to our good friend Giuseppe there for preparing our intro into the program. And again, thanks, folks, for being listeners and supporters of Revolution Radio. So come back and visit with us next week. Hope to see you then. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Cal.
Okay, take care, guys.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
Enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Zero X E 0 5 1 7 3.
We talk about this sample.